Crocher. Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. The Sustainable Forest Management Network engages scientists from across Canada in all kinds of forest research. Dr. Allison Munson is the ecologist who must develop a measuring stick for new forest practices, the criteria and the indicators of success in the forest. And technology commercialization. This year, the University of Alberta launches 9 new spin-off companies, bringing the total to 75 since 1963. So what better reason could there be to throw a party? All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. You'd never guess the quiet office at the back of the Biological Sciences Building is really the mission control for revolutionary movement. It's here that researchers from all across Canada gather to plot out a new paradigm for the management of our country's forests. Funded by government, industry, and a number of agencies, this is where the Sustainable Forest Management Network hangs its hat. One of the 100 or more researchers involved in this venture is Dr. Allison Munson, a forest ecologist from the University of Laval in Quebec City. It's her job to come up with the new criteria and the indicators that will measure forest sustainability.
I guess you could say it's a tool for measuring our progress towards sustainable forest management. We have to be able to define some certain objectives that we want to attain with sustainable forest management, and then we have to have a system of being able to say, yes, we've met those objectives or we haven't met those objectives. And criteria and indicators gives us that tool to measure our performance towards attaining the objectives.
Can you give me some examples of what some of those criteria and indicators might be?
Well, the main ones that are used are those defined by the Canadian Council of Forest Ministers, a group of ministers in forestry across the country, and they have defined a series of 6 criteria, including biodiversity, ecosystem productivity, soil and water conservation, multiple benefits of the forest, and also societal responsibility, including First Nations rights. So those are the main ones that are used as a base. And what we are trying to do is develop, in association with those criteria, indicators at the local level that will help us to measure our performance then in relation to those criteria.
I can't even imagine how you would begin to measure those sorts of things. What do you do?
For example, if I take the example of our own work, we're looking at, are we having an effect with our forestry practices on soil fertility in the long term? For example, the long-term forestry productivity. And to do that, we're looking at a certain indicator that we think will be pertinent for the particular land base that we're working with. And we're testing in the field, okay, does this indicator have some pertinence in this particular area? And then the intent is to take that indicator and actually integrate it into the management planning for the company Abitibi Consolidated.
What is the project that you're working on now that deals with this?
We have a global project with 7-8 researchers from a couple of universities in Quebec, Laval and UQAM. And what we're doing is, under each of those 6 criteria, we're trying to validate or test certain indicators for their pertinence in this particular land base, which is northwest of Quebec City. And so we have someone working in each of those disciplines who's tried to hone in on a particular indicator that's pertinent to that company in that particular area, and then to validate it and say, yes, no, this has, we can use it, it's pertinent, it has a sound scientific base, and then we try to operationalize it with the forest management planning cycle.
How exactly would that project be carried out? There's a relationship between a corporate entity and also university researchers. What kinds of things would you actually be doing? Are you going to be going out and spending time in the field, on their landscape, looking at what it is that they're doing?
There are actually a couple of different approaches depending on the indicator that we're looking at. In one case, for example, biodiversity, we have a student who's been going through the archives and looking at what was the condition of the forest before we started cutting the forest, and using old information about old aerial photographs, the first management plans of the company in that area, he's building this portrait of what was the forest just at the beginning of harvesting, and then he's going to use that information, look at the same kinds of information on the current state of the forest, and make some kind of comparison there on how the forest has been altered over time since we first started cutting, for example, way back in the 20s and 30s. And then he'll be able to say use certain indicators to say, yes, we've altered significantly the, for example, the ecological succession in the forest, and we've changed, for example, the state of the ecosystems in that there are not as many ecosystem types, or that we're starting to go towards less diversity. So that's a series of indicators that he's been using, mainly archival information. In another case, I have a student who's in the field doing very field-oriented work and looking at the state of the soils in both with under different practices, and so she's very it's a very different approach, but the end result will be the same, to use these indicators to test a certain indicator and then implement it.
Now, I can see how this might work if you have records that are generally accurate and go back a long period of time. But how do you deal with things like the water aspect of stuff, or even the social impacts or the social aspects of things?
The social aspects, we have another professor, Luc Boutier, who's been working on that. And he's been working even before this project was going, with the communities in that area and trying to get an idea of their perspectives of the forest in the first place, and also their values associated with the forest, and incorporating that into certain indicators for societal responsibility. He's also come up with a system that he calls a green accounting system, that tries to take into account these social values as well as ecological values, and put them all into one system of accounting that will give us a much broader perspective of how we're managing the forest, or how we're having an impact on the forest.
So in that sense, you're dealing with people's anecdotes or stories, or how they might remember things, not necessarily that's exactly the way things were. We all tend to romanticize the past, but what sense do you have of what people's concerns or values are that they associate with the forest?
I think there's a whole range of interesting perspectives in the same community. There are people that depend on the forest industry for their livelihood that are certainly concerned about the economics and how the industry is functioning, and will it be there for the long term. And that is their main concern. And then other people who are much more concerned about the state of wildlife, for example, because they like to be out hunting and fishing every weekend. And so they want to know, is the forest industry having an impact on what I'm going to be able to do in the future?
What are some of the things that you've found out so far that are sort of interesting?
We've found out that that there are, I think, changes in the forest that are important that have gone on in the past and that are continuing to happening. For example, we're losing much of our older age group of forest. We can look back and see how much forest would we naturally have that would be over a certain age group, for example. And I think we're able to see that portion of the forest is certainly shrinking with time. We can look and also see that the composition of the forest with harvest seems to be shifting as well. and we need to be aware what are the impacts in long term of that shift in possible succession paths and the composition of the forest that we'll have in the future.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Cheryl.
That was Dr. Allison Munson. She's a forest ecologist with the University of Laval in Quebec City, and her work is supported by the Sustainable Forest Management Network. These days, if you're doing research at a university, you're also thinking about how you can turn your invention or discovery into a business. Industry liaison and technology commercialization have taken hold of the academic world. Since 1963, the University of Alberta has launched 75 spin-off companies, and these generate significant economic activity. According to the latest statistics, just 8 of those spin-offs that are publicly traded have a market capitalization which exceeds $1.1 billion, and the current spin-offs have created more than 1,000 jobs. No wonder the University of Alberta decided it was time to celebrate its successes and announce the newest spin-off companies.
My name is Nick Nation, and I'm one of the people behind Histobest, which is a company specializing in microscope slides, in essence.
When did you start working on this?
We've been working on this for a couple of years, but the company's only existed since September.
And microscope slides, what does that do?
Well, in this case, we do not only the standard production of microscope slides for people to examine tissues, but we have a number of very specialized techniques that we've tweaked, and in essence, that's what we've formed the company around, is the tweakings of the process. We have two main approaches. One is that we can, by putting a large number of tissues on a slide in what is called a microarray, make much more efficient and cheaper certain scientific tests. And secondly, by doing this, we can also reduce the number of animals that are used in research. And so that's one of our interests as well.
How did you hit on this idea?
It wasn't so much that we hit on it, because the ideas have been around for a long time. In essence, though, what we did is just improved the way it can be done. And so this is a slow increase in the in efficiency and the quality of research samples.
What's your market?
Our market right now is, in essence, the researchers at U of A. And beyond that will be other researchers in institutions in Canada and North America. This isn't the type of thing that would be of any interest or particular value to the general public, but particularly in the biological sciences, it has great applications.
Are you going to make your millions off this?
No, this isn't the type of thing that makes millions. This is something that keeps one interested and involved.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
That was Nick Nation of Histobest. Another newcomer to the marketplace is Big Bangwidth. Brian Moore is the company's chief technology officer.
It's a play on words, basically. It's the Big Bang. It's the how the universe started with a lot of light. And what we do is we're developing technology that carries light on fiber optic cables to allow large bandwidth, Big Bang, to desktops, to computers, to your home. Basically putting the internet on steroids.
As a spin-off company from the U of A, how did you get started at the U of A? What was the seed of this?
Well, the seed of it is an investment probably 15 or 20 years ago by the province of Alberta. They created the Alberta Microelectronics Center, which was developing miniaturization technology for various applications. I worked at that center for about 7 years, and as a result of knowing that space of technology, came up with some ideas that would be applicable in the commercial world.
What were some of those ideas?
Well, that's the basis of the product, basically, how to create optical switching, how to do it in a form which is much more economic than previous techniques.
Well, if this is something that got its start 15 years ago, how do you stay with it so long?
Well, the investment by the province started 15 years ago. The particular application only started when I started the company a year and a half ago. So the basis of the technology, if it's like bricks and mortar, if you will, you can't add a second floor unless you have the basement built. So the technology that we're developing in the company was based on previous technology developments and skills and people trained at the University of Alberta. We hire new graduates that go through the system and know some of the equipment and some of the technology and some of the science needed to do this kind of work.
Just getting this thing off the ground and becoming a spin-off company, what kind of money are you talking about? What sort of investment?
Well, we raised $3 million in venture capital to start the company off, and to address a market of several billion dollars, you need to invest in advanced technology, and that's the order of dollars you need. You can't start with $100,000. All that'll do is waste the money, basically. You have to have enough critical mass to do something real in the world.
Did you ever think you'd be heading up a company?
I had the idea in the back of my mind, and I did a lot of, in my job at the university, I did a lot of assessments on technology for funding for other people, scientific assessments, funding assessments. And based on that experience, I thought I had at least part of the skill set required to do a startup.
What's it like? How do you maintain your research aspect on things and still do the business thing? Don't you find that you're being pulled in far too many directions?
Oh, absolutely. There's never enough time in the day to do things. And that's why you need a management team to do things in a high-tech startup. Typically, a founder and a businessman will get together and form a company. But you need lead scientists. You need marketing people. It's a multiple skill set required to carry an enterprise forward. And that's what we've done at Big Bang with some of the proceeds of the venture capital that we raised. We hired some critical marketing and critical accounting people to keep the ship running, and some scientists on board too to do the R&D.
What are some of the things that you've been warned about from other people who have been into this a little bit before you? Have they given you any warning signs or some advice to keep you afloat?
Well, I think the kind of advice that is very appreciated is open your eyes up, get out of necessarily the parochial Edmonton scene, look at wider vistas, go to the States, go to some trade shows and see how commerce works and see how venture capital is raised, not in the local community, but where there's a larger traffic of that. And that's kind of a U.S., Eastern Canada. Add all those ideas together and synthesize a company out of that.
What's your market?
Our market is really the high-end enterprise market, where large companies or scientific enterprises have peer-to-peer computing, large databases that they have to move information around. Any computer you buy now maybe runs at a gigahertz or dual processors. They've really advanced quite a bit. What is not advanced is the communication connecting them together. So that's the solution we're working on and providing to customers, is providing high-speed connectivity for all of those expensive computers that everyone bought.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
That was Brian Moore, the Chief Technology Officer with Big Bang Whip. One U of A spin-off company that's been around a while and is often in the news is the biotech firm Biomira. Manning the Biomira booth at the celebration was Dwayne Bruner, who looks after investor relations.
Biomira is a cancer vaccine company. We're located here in Edmonton, Research Park, and we're a spinoff actually of the University of Alberta from 1985.
Investor relations, what do you have to do with that?
Investor relations primarily is any stockholder communications or shareholder relations, where we talk to shareholders, prospective institutions who want to invest in Biomira, and as well retail investors and that sort of thing, to try and procure funds and keep the stock price at a reasonable level.
Well, judging from what I've heard about fundraising for spin-off companies, this is a really big job.
Yeah, it is actually. It's a full-time job. There's a team of three of us actually that we travel and we set up investor shows and tours and conferences and try and maintain the Biomira name in the public realm so that we can attract new and high wealth investors, basically.
What are the challenges of trying to raise investment?
Probably the biggest challenge is currently is that a company like ourselves, we're in clinical trials. So when you have nothing to market or sell and you have negative earnings, it's a bit of a hard sell that way. So we promote our story and we alert people to the fact that we will be a profitable company at one point and we'll be marketing something, and people get really excited because the return on investment is there, the value is a big driver.
I'd sure like to know how you do it, because I can't run my household that way.
Yeah, well, it's been an interesting tack, that's for sure.
How did you get involved with this?
Actually, I've done investor relations for quite a while. I worked in the oil and gas industry down in Calgary, so it's a bit of a challenge to do biotechnology, but it makes the job that more challenging.
What is up next for Biomira?
Right now, we're at a very exciting stage in our development. Our current lead drug is called Theratope, and it's in medical testing for phase 3 testing for women with metastatic breast cancer. So we've been developing this drug since 1991, and we're right at the end of the process for us. We have the opportunity to look at the data from that phase 3 trial this coming fall. And if we see something statistically significant, we can discuss filing for approval with the FDA. So we're right at the end of the whole process.
When will that be on the market once you go through that FDA process?
Well, I think in a very aggressive way, we could actually be marketing this product following an approval into 2004. So again, when you think of where we are in relation to where we started, it's pretty exciting times for us.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you.
That was Dwayne Bruner, Investor Relations Manager with Biomira. The company that started the spin-off craze at the U of A back in 1963 is now known as Raylo Chemicals. Dr. Jerry Tertsakian was a chemist who joined the company in 1966. He later bought it and then ran it as CEO after selling it to a British multinational. I spoke with him in his office about Raylo's early days.
That was 1963. And it was put together by Professor Ray Lemieux of the university, and a very eminent chemist who did a lot of work on carbohydrate chemistry. So the name of the company today is Raylo Chemicals. At the time when it was first spawned, it was called R&L Molecular Research. And R referred to Ray for his first name, and L referred to Leo, his brother's first name.
What were they actually working on?
Again, it's a little convoluted story. Ray was a very eminent chemist, as I said, with quite a bit of fame. He was a carbohydrate chemist. He's the first person at all in the world to synthesize, to make in the laboratory, just plain table sugar. Table sugar is a fairly complicated molecule, and Ray was the first to do it. In fact, he did that in Saskatoon, of all things, at the National Research Council Laboratory. And then he went to Ottawa, and from Ottawa he was, because he's an Alberta boy, he got recruited back to Edmonton. University of Alberta hired him. And he came to Edmonton, but almost at the same time, this is 1962, almost at the same time, he was approached by large American multinational pharmaceutical company, Bristol-Myers, to actually work for them in Syracuse, New York. Ray was actually the very first person, I think, in the technology world anyway, from Edmonton, who said, look, I can do the work you want in Edmonton, and I'll do it for you. I'll set up a lab, you just pay my way. And he opened up R&L Molecular Research to do research exclusively for the 3 years for Bristol-Myers Laboratories. And the work at the time was on a variety of penicillins. Penicillin was still fairly new, and all sorts of derivatives of penicillins were being discovered and put into action. So that lab was dedicated to making penicillins.
Over the years, you've really seen the gamut. How have things changed from when there was that first spin-off company in 1963 and where things are at now in terms of helping the different research projects get off the ground and make it into the marketplace?
It's changed very substantially, very, very substantially, in the sense that the technology companies as such in the early days were an aberration. They were strange things to have around, and people didn't know technology company. Oh, I don't know anything about that. Today, it's changed from the investor point of view, although a lot of investors still say that. On the other hand, a lot of them say, a technology company. Let's see what's in it, because now they're much more familiar with the existence of these companies. Venture capital didn't exist. Today, it does. And, their money is good. There's no question. The university particularly has changed. Earlier on, especially, and I know Ray Lemieux was a wonderful person, and in a sense he was my mentor, and we were friends till his last days. When he first spun out of the university and started Arundel Molecular Research, it was in fact frowned upon by the university. It was considered to be very crass and very lowly to go from academia into business. I mean, how low can you sink? Today, that's changed very considerably. In fact, it's quite the opposite. Today, the researchers more and more look for opportunities to commercialize their products. So, and the university accepts, not only accepts, but promotes this, as shown in this forum yesterday. So it has changed very considerably by technology companies of all shapes, whether it's information technology, biotechnology, or whatever, or even oil and gas technology. I mean, that's high technology too. All these are accepted now as facts of life. And there is a complete infrastructure that caters to them, which was absolutely absent in those days.
That was Dr. Jerry Tertsakian. He's now an angel investor to fledgling technology companies through his own company, Hannibal Ventures. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Health Sciences Association of Alberta, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, True North Energy, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Research Council, and the Alberta Conservation Association. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is produced by Porcupine Stone Productions. I'm Cheryl Croucher.